Thank you for joining us. I am Dr. Charles Bennett. I'm an MD, PhD, hematologist, oncologist, and I'm a what's called a Smart State Chair and Director of the Smart State Center at the University of South Carolina. It's one of 47 endowed chairs in the state of South Carolina, and my program focuses on medication safety and efficacy. With me for presentation are Dr. Mark Fishman, founder and chairman of the Board of Directors of Oncology Analytics Incorporated. It's in Atlanta, Georgia. And Dr. Kevin Knopf, who's the chief of the section of hematology oncology at Alameda Health Systems and Highland Hospital, which is in Oakland, California. In today's presentation, we're going to provide information on key scientific factors that are around biosimilarity, and also address drug interchangeability, which is one of the most confusing terms we have today in biosimilars. We're going to talk about the potential clinical and regulatory challenges to the uptake of biosimilars for supportive care in the cancer patients in the United States, particularly those with hematologic malignancies. And we'll discuss the challenges and opportunities to overcome barriers and the care disparities related to the uptake and adoption of biosimilars in comparison to original biologics. And we'll have that as a sort of the third part of the presentation today. Let's talk about the global cancer biologics market. Very simple slide here showing that the growth of the cancer market is about 7.2% to $93 billion in 2025, estimated. And it was 6.9% in 2021. In 2020, it was about $66 billion. So if you look overall, you're going from a left bar of $66 billion to the right bar of $93 billion. A huge anticipated growth for cancer global market. This is the entire world at the same time. Biologics. Drug therapies are integral to the treatment of cancer patients. These include cell therapies, cytokines, growth factors, monoclonal antibodies, and monoclonal antibody drug toxin combinations. And they're all produced, and we'll go into that a little bit later, in a living system, which makes them complex to produce. Given their complexity, they're expensive. The median annual cost of biologics therapy for oncology, hematology, biologics today are about $142,000 per patient. Really difficult to think of that number. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration, our regulatory agency, they have defined a biosimilar. It's a biological product that is highly similar to and has no clinically meaningful differences from the existing FDA-approved reference biologic. And these were formally established by the FDA in 2015, a full decade after they were established in Europe. And so on the left, you can see in the shaded region, highly similar. They're extensively analyzed. They have comparative characteristics, and they have minor differences that are acceptable. On the right, we show that they have no clinically meaningful differences in terms of safety, purity, and potency. And they're demonstrated through human studies, pharmacokinetics, pharmacodynamics, and immunogenicity to be about the same as the parent drug. At this point, I'd like to turn over to Kevin, Dr. Knopf, to continue the discussion on a few of the clinical considerations we do and we use in demonstrating biosimilarity.
Thank you. The goal of biosimilars is to lower the cost of care in cancer and other areas where they're used, and the clinical trials to establish similar efficacy and safety compared with the reference project, not to reestablish benefit. So the way I think about this is the way I think about a generic drug, that the biosimilar drug works as well as the reference product. Clinical trial program includes assessments of pharmacokinetics, if possible, pharmacodynamics, efficacy and safety, and the use of short-term surrogate endpoints with either one-arm or two-arm studies. In some settings, no clinical trials for cancer patients are needed for FDA approval of the oncology biosimilar, and preclinical data can constitute 90% of the dossier. clinical considerations in demonstrating biosimilarity, the patient population that is of interest for the reference drug and the biosimilar drug should show clinically meaningful benefit or differences. The dose, including the pharmacokinetics, the dose response curve, can be chosen to sensitively detect any differences between the biosimilar and the reference drug. The endpoints to enable precise and meaningful comparisons to reference biologic, and the design of the trial, typically non-inferiority or equivalence, parallel crossover depending on the half-life of the agent.
So as you can see in the, on those kind of issues, when we talk about biosimilars and generics, these are very different, even though they sound like they should be the same. Biosimilars are biologic medicines. Generics, these identical twins, are conventional medicines. They develop the biosimilars. They're shown, as Dr. Knopf just mentioned, they're supposed to be highly similar and not identical to the original, the originator. And then you see in the generics in the second row on this slide, they're supposed to be identical, just like identical twins to the originator, bioequivalent studies. This is really a key distinction. The approval in the third row of the biosimilars, they get the EMA or the FDA will approve these products, whereas the generics, they get approved by the countries rather than in Europe, each individual country, or the FDA. And on the fourth row, you can see that biosimilars have a potential to be immunogenic. Generics have none. The nomenclature in the fifth row, they use the trade names or to use the distinguishable names with different suffixes. So those of you who are starting to use some generics right now, you might get into some names that sound so foreign because they may not be similar to the names that you would have used with the reference drug. Whereas the generics, they use the basic generic drug name. Interchangeability, the next row, is an important concept. It means what it says, interchangeable. You can change one out for the other. But the FDA has not yet assessed, established, or approved a single interchangeable biologic yet. The generics, they all are interchangeable. That means if you get the prescription for generic A today and generic B next month, you're good to go. On the other hand, with interchangeables, you get biosimilar A this month, you're not good to go to biosimilar B next month. They're not interchangeable yet. Substitution, next row, is not yet assessed, again, established, or approved. Substitution is when, rather than you deciding which one you might want, substitution would be the pharmacist might say, let's give you biosimilar A today. Generics, always. You go in and the pharmacist has the ability to substitute the generic for the primary drug unless the physician says not to do so. If you get an adverse drug reaction, they want you to report both the name of the drug and the batch number, because the batch number could be faulty. On the other hand, generics, you put just the name of the drug. The risk management plan is by the FDA, and that is where they're carefully looking to see if there's any risk management issues. And that's done on all biosimilars, not done on generics. Price discounting, we're looking about 20 to 30% price discount over the originator, is what we try to see in the U.S., whereas in the generics, it's a good 80 to 90% discount. How long does it take to develop these things? A biosimilar is about 8 to 10 years. Generic, 3 to 5 years. How long does it take to how much does it cost to develop these drugs? It costs $100 million to $200 million for development costs for biosimilars and $1 million to $5 million for generic. And that explains to you very quickly why there are certain companies have to be well capitalized, well financed to do biosimilar production, whereas the generics have a plethora of generic manufacturers. As I mentioned in the beginning, the biosimilars have been in place in the European since 2005, 2006, 10 years before us. In the United States, it's rising, biosimilars, but they compromise only 2.3% of all biologics in the country compared to 90% in the EU. Mark, Dr. Fishman, why don't you talk to us now about the U.S. experience with biosimilars?
This is a list of the 29 FDA approval biosimilars currently available. As you can see, there's two for bevacizumab or Avastin. There's a number of them for pegfilgrastim and rituximab and trastuzumab. This slide shows the currently approved granulocyte colony stimulating factors. And as you can see, the first one, 2012, we had TBO filgrastim, which is actually a very cost-effective drug, but it's not a biosimilar because it wasn't technically, it functions as a biosimilar in my mind, but it's not wasn't approved as a biosimilar because there wasn't an approval process. Subsequently, Zarxio and Nivastim, and I use the brand names even though I don't like to, because using the product names is confusing, and we can see when those were approved. Pegfilgrastim is interesting. We have the four long-acting pegfilgrastim products, but none of them have the facility that Neulasta, the brand and original brand drug, has of being able to apply a device to the arm and have it deliver the medication the next day. For all of these biosimilars, patients will have to come to the office or have someone administer the biosimilar the day after, or at least one day after the chemotherapy is administered. Now, Dr. Knopf will speak a little bit more about the approved indications for the originator and biosimilar GCSFs.
Thank you. These are all agents that are used to decrease the drop in white blood cell count when we give cytotoxic chemotherapy. The long-acting versions, filgrastim, the short-acting versions, and then the long-acting versions. These are the short-acting versions, and their approvals are basically the same as that for the originator GCSF, as listed on this table here: decreased incidence of infection in patients with non-myeloid malignancies receiving myelosuppressive chemotherapy, given to reduce the time to neutrophil recovery in AML patients, reduced duration of neutropenia while undergoing myeloablative therapy for bone marrow transplant, for leukapheresis purposes, for acute radiation syndrome, which is an uncommon utilization, and to treat neutropenic disorders in patients who have those rare disorders. The similar indications are for the long-acting GCSF, which are more convenient for the patients than daily GCSF for 5 to 8 doses, to decrease the incidence of infections and febrile neutropenia for patients receiving cytotoxic chemotherapy, and to increase in survival in patients exposed to myelosuppressive doses of radiation, which hopefully does not happen that often. We'll go back to Dr. Bennett now.
Thank you, Kevin. We have started now to do meta-analyses. And the meta-analyses, as you can see in the slide, for GCSF, PEG-G versus biosimilar PEG-G, has shown really that these drugs on the meta-analytic basis are very similar. And by that, I mean, when you look at the middle figure, it has a long line down the middle around zero. And the point, the little square, the black line is touching zero, which says statistically and analytically that these products are biosimilar, and they're very similar in efficacy between the biosimilar drug and the reference drug. And as you see, the individual clinical trials, people like Kim Blackwell, early investigators, 2016, 2015, did the work. And so we have quite a bit of knowledge that's allowed us to put 7 studies together with a total of 800 patients to allow us to say that the GCSF and the PEG-GCSF are biosimilar and analytically similar in terms of safety and efficacy between that and the reference drugs. This is work that was published in the European Journal of Cancer. The U.S. experience is a little bit clearly less mature, because the Europeans started using biosimilar G in 2007. This is my work that was published. We just got it ahead of print. It's in The Oncologist, and we may be able to find a way to get to you later. But the oncologist has done a nice job of keeping up with each of these biosimilars one by one. So I refer that to you to get to look at it if you can. The biosimilar filgrastim was approved in 2016. And by 2017, 1 year, 50% market share. Unbelievable. Very great uptake. And the factors that led to this marked uptake was that large insurers designated the biosimilar filgrastim to be the preferred drug over reference filgrastim. The oncologists in practice have had no problem accepting biosimilar filgrastim as having similar safety and efficacy. And there's always been a big push to educating oncologists. Here it's worked. We also had an important settling of patent litigation between the manufacturers and the reference to biosimilar. And of course, in most cases, not all, most cases, there's lower pricing after rebates for biosimilar filgrastim. And this has worked, as I mentioned, was an oncologist. The U.S. European EPOTA experience is a little bit newer. And of course, we try to update ourselves with that. And so I refer to you at the bottom. We have a similar paper just came out. EPOTA had a print in the oncologist on the biosimilar EPO. In 2018, the biosimilar EPO was launched. Wasn't much different than that one, 5.7% lower, and its use was not very big. Over time, people got better discounts. United Healthcare, other places became more supportive. Use of biosimilar EPO went from 0.4% to 45%. Here we have in 2020, besides United Healthcare, Aetna, Humana picking up biosimilar as preferred. And the final look that we have in this slide, as well as in my manuscript, 82% utilization. So it's gone from 0.4% in 2018 to 82% in 2020. The biosimilar pipeline landscape as of 3 months ago, we have filgrastim, we have EPOs, we have pegfilgrastim. Dr. Fishman went over those, and Dr. Knopf, and you can see that pipeline is starting to fill up tremendously. Pegfilgrastim, as we saw, Neulasta, and then we have, besides the accepted, approved, and marketed biosimilar pegfilgrastims, you see 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 more coming on market as soon as they get approved. 5 more to get approved, let me clarify, if they get through trials. And a filgrastim, we have 4 more. So at the end of the day, we will have 9 biosimilar filgrastims if they all get approved, and 10 biosimilar filgrastims. This is going back to spaces we've never even imagined when we started talking about these products. Safety. I'm like the safety maven around the world in terms of things that I think about in oncology. But I have to say, at the end of the day, I've spent a lot of time looking at biosimilar safety, and I'm really impressed with the safety efforts that have been done. The FDA has made guidance. Their studies that assess adverse events and ADRs. The FDA has not issued guidance on studies for interchangeability yet. And so there's some concern in interchangeability of whether there'll be immunogenicity if you go from one back and forth to the other. We've never seen that yet. And we have not seen it with any of the other biosimilars, even in non-oncology space. And there's not a lot of antibodies that are forming and developing in these biosimilars yet at this point either. Interchangeability, if you ever want to get in a fight at a party, just talk about interchangeability. This is so difficult. The FDA says they want to be interchangeable to be shown in clinical trials, yet there's never been a study that shows interchangeability. There's no, as stated, as shown in red, there are no FDA-approved biologics in the United States that meet the criteria listed in the BPCI, Biologics Price Competition Innovation Act, for interchangeable biosimilar. So at this point, your pharmacist is unable to substitute a biosimilar for reference biologics and not interchangeable. And the FDA is getting so many messages that they will have to come up with a much more manageable approach to interchangeability. Extrapolation is another term that you won't get as much flack at a party about, but you should know about. And I think we heard in the earlier slide presentations, we saw when some of the look at the FDA-approved indications that Dr. Knopf went through for the filgrastim. They didn't do a clinical trial in all those settings. What they did do is called extrapolate. And the FDA has said, just like Europe, that if your product's approved in one setting and it's likely to be a similar mechanism in another setting, it can get a regulatory approval in that setting. So in the United States, many biosimilars have been granted extrapolation. And full extrapolation for all clinical indications approved by the reference biologic would be helpful, because if they extrapolate and approve 6 out of 10 indications, sometimes people are going to say, which one of the 4 is extrapolated that's not working out, and which one is the 6 is worked out? We think, and this is the work that we published in, again, in The Oncologist, we strongly think the extrapolation should be complete for each biologic. And so we have other solutions that we've talked about in barriers. And so the regulatory policy, the approval process, interchangeability and extrapolation needs to be fixed. We don't need to have problems and fights and parties about interchangeability and extrapolation. The economics, these non-transparent rebates make it almost impossible to compare prices. And the perceptions have to be fixed. We need to continue to educate providers to talk about the similarities and efficacy and safety. One of the nice papers on this is written by Chadi Nabhan, one of my collaborators with my sonar program in 2018 in The Oncologist, and it gives you a nice overview as well. I'll turn over to Mark now to provide us information on the economics of biosimilars.
Thank you, Charlie. This slide shows that the typical price for a biosimilar in the United States is only about 15%, sometimes up to 35% lower than the reference product. Not dramatic reductions, but significant. And the economic effect of biosimilars hinges on the pharmacovigilance and safety of the agents, the endorsement by the medical community. But I don't really think that's of particular concern, nor patient acceptance. There have been things stated or written that patients don't want biosimilars. We have not found that to be the case. Then there's the price. And then it's when you look at price, that's a pretty broad word. It's the price to whom? Is it the cost to the health plan, the cost to the patient? By inference, there's also profitability that's related to price. Then there's competition amongst the various agents. We haven't really seen that in the biosimilars as a major factor in which drug a physician might prefer or choose. Starting with endorsement by the medical community, I'd like to separate this into both the treatment of the cancer, whether you're talking about cure or overall survival, and then the supportive agents. And personally, I look at them very differently. I don't think physicians in the community look at them very differently, though, because we do not get demands for the originator pharmaceutical when there's a request for a treatment drug, like, say, rituximab or bevacizumab. And if a patient fails and progresses on one of the treatment drugs, we don't have people saying, oh, well, that patient failed on the biosimilar bevacizumab, I want to try the originator drug. We don't really see that, although logically, I would think that that might make more sense than requests for the originator drug in the supportive care environment. Because with supportive care, whether it's a white cell or a red cell growth factor, you can see the results. If you give a white cell growth factor, the neutrophils will either increase or they won't. We don't see people saying it didn't increase with the biosimilar, I want to use the originator. We just don't see that. Nor do we see resistance where if a health plan prefers through the CMS, Medicare-approved step therapy programs, if the step therapy program requires stepping through, say, Zarxio before you get Neupogen, we don't see people saying, I won't use Zarxio, I don't think it works. We don't see that. We do see people saying, it's not on our formulary, we don't have it, and so we can't use it because the patient needs it today and it's not on our formulary. There's been talk about patient acceptance. We've never heard about a patient saying, I want the brand drug. It's theoretically possible, but I think that patients now, specifically referring to supportive care, the treating physician will say something like, your white cell count or your hemoglobin is low and we're going to give you something to increase it. And that's the end of it. The patient doesn't say, I don't want the biosimilar. The patient will be interested in the price. And we know that because there's a lot of financial stress placed on cancer patients, and they have copays. Patients will generally prefer a lower copay. In 2019, U.S. health plans covered biosimilars as preferred in 14% of decisions. That seems to be going up quite significantly. And then there's a question of rebates, as I alluded to, that manufacturers provide rebates. We don't know how much. We don't know precisely to whom. Copays are based often on the cost of the drug, the list price of the drug, not the price after rebate. And I think a key thing and something that we would, I think, all like to see changed would be more clarity, more transparency on rebates. I'd like to turn this over to Dr. Knopf again to give us a view of how all of this comes together from his clinical experience.
Thank you. I'm interested in healthcare disparities and health economics, and a lot of healthcare disparities has to do with how assets are allocated among different patient populations. The high cost of biologic therapies, I think, exacerbates some healthcare disparities and leads to inequities in use of these agents and probably affects cancer outcomes worse for certain patient populations in America. The biosimilars represent a cost-effective alternative to the reference product. They provide the same quality and efficacy of care at a lower cost. So from the greater healthcare system, they're a win situation in that they may enhance health equity. To increase uptake of these agents, awareness must be increased by providers and patients. Most Americans have never heard of biosimilars, although the majority of them are aware of generic drugs. And the negative perceptions of any patients or physicians around biosimilars should also be addressed. From our healthcare system, is a public hospital. We care for the underserved, those with public insurance, either Medicare, Medicaid, or uninsured. And actually, California as a whole, more than half of California's healthcare is delivered to patients who have public insurance, whether it's at a county hospital like ours or a private hospital elsewhere in California. We collaborated with a local Medicaid HMO who was also interested in cost-effective care to look at our utilization of biosimilar medicines. And we had a plan definitively as soon as a biosimilar became available. We put it on our formulary and quickly moved to 100% adoption in the hematology-oncology space. We're a little bit slower in GI and rheumatology and neurology, but we're getting closer to 100% in those other fields. So these are all patients who receive treatment at our institutions in the infusion center. Our system requires that the product be on market for 6 months and go through our pharmaceutical and therapeutics committee. To date, 100% of medicines that have come on the market have been approved by our P&T committee as soon as they're available. And then I have mandated for all our oncologists that everybody use 100% biosimilars unless there's a strong and valid objection, in which case an exception can be made. Our other specialties are not yet at 100%, but they are getting closer and closer, and I anticipate that they will be at 100% within the next 6 to 12 months.
So let's give you some quick questions we want to cover. Overall, we want to ask the question, have oncology biosimilars been the large economic change agent that the United States has hoped for? And I put down as a short answer, billions of dollars of savings have yet to be realized. We heard from Kevin's presentation, 100% utilization in his hospital. Mark has said there's been a pretty large uptake, especially amongst the different insurers. I've practiced in the VA, and there's been a big uptake in the VA. But clearly, we've been looking for $25 billion, $30 billion in savings. We have not seen that savings yet. So we're still looking, and it still has room to go. How do we get there? The path forward, I think it's strong. The fact that the formulary decisions are favoring oncology drugs as preferred options is really opening the door. And one of the key barriers I think we should discuss and we've talked about is the fact that I think Mark made a point that education has been pretty proactive. You have had a lot of education of what biosimilars are amongst oncologists. On the other hand, Kevin made a strong point that when you ask somebody on the street, what is a biosimilar, they look at you like you have two heads. Acceptance is also an important issue. I went through the data in my presentation as the fact is the data strongly support that there's been statistical and analytics studies to show that there's these biosimilars are about the same safety and efficacy as the reference drug. The FDA has to improve its clarity. We have to be able to identify what it means to be interchangeable, what it means to be extrapolation, and that's going to be complete. I want to thank you. I want to thank Kevin and Mark and the audience for participating and hopefully participating in our studies. Thank you very much.